It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, we talk about a new study that says poverty can impact a person's DNA and raise the risk of depression. First, the city of Waukesha will be able to source its drinking water from Lake Michigan under a plan approved today by the Great Lakes Water Council. Though Waukesha is not in the Great Lakes watershed, it requested the ability to pull water from Lake Michigan because the wells that provide its current drinking water are contaminated. The unanimous decision today from the Great Lakes Compact Council came after years of planning, voting, and negotiations. Joining us now is Wisconsin Public Radio reporter Chuck Kornbach. He's been covering the Waukesha Diversion Plan and was at the vote in Chicago today. Chuck, good to have you back on Central Time.
Thank you and good afternoon.
So let's just get a quick refresher here. What was at stake today?
Well, basically boiled down to Waukesha's plan to pipe in about 8 million gallons a day of drinking water from Lake Michigan, use it, of course, and then treat the wastewater, send it back in a pipe that would connect to the Root River in about Franklin, and then the wastewater would flow down into Lake Michigan at Racine. That was approved 8-0, as you mentioned.
So, Chuck, why did Waukesha make this application in the first place? What is the state of Waukesha's water?
Well, as you mentioned, it has radium problems in the wells, and even though environmentalists and others contend that Waukesha could just do a better job of treating the wastewater, the contaminated well water, or find other water sources, Waukesha said, no, the best thing we could do is get Lake Michigan water. So they've been pursuing this, as you said, for years. It's really like 13 or 14 years they've been making an effort in this regard with a more formal plan for the last 5 years. So it's a long time in coming. Waukesha officials, several who attended today, very happy. Afterwards, Waukesha Mayor Sean Riley used the word joy to describe how he felt.
So who was at the meeting and voting today?
Well, it was the representatives from the 8 Great Lakes states. The Canadian provincial officials were part of an earlier review that was approved for the plan. So it's just the 8 Great Lakes representatives. No governors there today. Wisconsin Governor Scott Walker, not to be seen today. He's going to hold a victory celebration, I think, tomorrow in Waukesha about this. But today's representative was DNR Secretary Kathy Stepp, first time she's attended this. She's also very happy. She voted for this, of course, and says that Wisconsin, the DNR will be very open in its review. It's proceeding with this now with Waukesha, and that will be very transparent.
As you said, Chuck, this has been a process going on for several years. In the end, did Waukesha need to make any concessions to have the plan approved?
Well, I think there were some, certainly, that the amount of water Waukesha wanted originally was around 10 million gallons, maybe even more. At the previous committee work over this spring, that was whittled down to about 8 million gallons. Also, the service area, the areas that would receive the Great Lakes water, got knocked down to just the city of Waukesha plus what they call town islands, town of Waukesha islands that are pretty much completely surrounded by the city of Waukesha. The original proposal had several other Waukesha suburbs, if you will, also getting lake water, and that got shot down to where it's just the city and these few town islands. So the Waukesha had a compromise on that. They also had to accept some language that was debated today. Minnesota and Michigan proposed several amendments, one that will make it easier for the other states to, with 30 days notice, audit what Waukesha is doing, and also take a closer look at the DNR records on this. So, you know, Wisconsin and Waukesha could have balked at some of that, but they went along with it, and today's meeting really only lasted about an hour and a half.
We're talking with Chuck Kornbach. He's Wisconsin Public Radio's reporter based in Milwaukee, and he was in Chicago today for the meeting of the Great Lakes Compact Council. They voted unanimously to approve the city of Waukesha's request to divert water from Lake Michigan. Now, Chuck, you just mentioned something that I found interesting. You said that there is a a part of the agreement that says that the Waukesha use can be audited, that the DNR's documentation on this can be looked at. Is there any kind of recourse if any of those states involved or those Canadian provinces find that something is not going as expected or Waukesha is not living up to the terms of the agreement?
Yeah, there was definitely more reinforcement today also that other parties, not citizens, but the states, could take action. They'd have to go through the courts, of course, to get sort of an enforcement. But there was, sort of a hard line put in by some of these other states saying, listen, we're going ahead with this, but we want to make sure we can review it, and we want to make sure the citizens can take a look at things, and the other states would take action if they needed to. Political leaders in other states change. At some point, they might be more skeptical about Waukesha's plan. And certainly, the other thing that, was the reaction today from other folks, environmental groups praised the committee for whittling down the size of the request, but also it promised monitoring of this, and a coalition of Great Lakes and St. Lawrence City's mayors, their spokesperson said several Great Lakes mayors are very upset with this. So whether they're going to try to sue or not, there will be close eyes on this, it appears, for a while.
So, Chuck, does this set any kind of precedent going forward for other communities who are not actually within the Great Lakes watersheds but might make these kind of applications, or is it such a case-by-case unique basis that there's not really much precedent to be set?
Well, it depends on interpretation. The Alliance for the Great Lakes and environmental groups sort of said, listen, other communities are looking at lake water now. Be careful because Waukesha spent millions of dollars on this and consultant fees and others in preparing its proposal. And it took months to get an approval, and they lost 20% of what they wanted. So there's sort of a warning shot from the environmental groups. The Great Lakes Mayors Group is sort of saying, though, that, wait, we're worried that this opens the barn door to many other communities at the straddling counties that straddle the Great Lakes watershed or the basin to apply. So we may see more how quickly it depends. It's going to take Waukesha a couple of years, I think, to actually get the pipes built and the system working. The Waukesha's Mayor Riley wouldn't say exactly when, but it's going to be a while, so I don't know whether the other communities will see how it actually works for Waukesha or whether they'll now go ahead and apply.
So, Chuck, you're saying that some of the infrastructure still needs to be built, so it's not like tomorrow they're going to turn on a spigot and the water's going to start flowing.
There's been preliminary work, I think, done, and certainly Waukesha has upgraded its wastewater treatment plant, but there still has to be a pipe between Waukesha and Oak Creek, inland and ways from Lake Michigan, where they're going to get the westbound water, if you will, and then a pipe built from the Waukesha treatment plant back to the city of Franklin, where the river flows for return back to Racine.
So what does Waukesha do in the interim before they have it ready, all the infrastructure ready to start taking that Lake Michigan water? They're dealing with those contaminated wells at home already. So what do they do in the interim?
Well, I think there'll be some continued pumping from them. The radium problem is a concern, but it's not an urgent concern for some. Certainly, Waukesha will be continuing to do water conservation measures that it had to show that it was doing in this whole compact review process. And I don't know, could be other steps depending on rainfalls and city demand, but there's been efforts to restrict demand somewhat while this goes ahead. But they did have some time legally under the federal radium rules to get this done.
Before we let you go, Chuck, you've been following this issue for a long time and attending many of these meetings. Were you surprised that it was a unanimous vote in favor of the proposal?
Well, the previous committee a month ago did 8-0-1. I think Minnesota abstained. There were negotiations and talks, and it sounded like Michigan and Minnesota got together on some of these amendments, and there was a meeting with some folks with the Wisconsin DNR along the way, including just before the actual meeting today. So everybody kind of knew what was going in. There weren't any surprises. I think environmental groups and reporters sort of concluded in the last 6 hours, 18 hours that this was going to go through. So not a huge surprise. But, you know, when you step back and you're talking a $200 million project that transfers water in and out of the basin, basically, that it, you take a look back and say, wow, that is a major thing, and it's kind of surprising.
Well, Chuck, thanks so much for spending the time with us.
Thank you.
Chuck Kornbach is a reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio News and has been covering the Waukesha diversion issue. The Great Lakes Compact Council today unanimously approved the city's request to divert water from Lake Michigan. Well, coming up, we talk to the co-author of a study that finds that poverty can alter DNA and put people at risk for depression. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll talk about a new plan okayed by the U.S. Senate that would require women to register for the draft. First, a growing body of research is showing that poverty isn't just something that affects bank accounts and household budgets. It's also something that impacts health. Previous studies have linked poverty to depression and other mental health issues. But recent research out of Duke University says that growing up with scarce resources can actually cause genetic alterations and put people at greater risk for depression. Joining us now is one of the study's co-authors, Douglas Williamson. He's a professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University. Doug, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So there are plenty of studies out there that have looked at poverty and depression. What makes this one different?
Well, the thing that's different about this study is we have begun to move from just looking at poverty and the stress of poverty in general to begin to identify what the brain-based mechanisms are that are affected by this pathway, and then also how genetics impact brain development during this critical period in development, adolescence.
So you chose to study adolescence. Why did you take that age group in particular?
Well, one of the main risk factors for depression that we've identified to date is a familial risk for it. So if you have a parent or brother and sister with lifetime depression, an aunt, uncle, or grandparent with lifetime depression, you're at a fourfold increased risk for developing a first episode of depression by age 18. Mm. As a result of that, our work has been focusing on the 12 to 15 year age range period to begin to look at them before they actually develop it in that critical 15 to 20 year window.
So when you're talking about that much higher likelihood of having that first depressive episode, if you have that family history, what is it about that family history? Is that actually a biological connection, or is that an atmosphere, or it's kind of the nature or nurture?
Well, technically, it could be both. And what you're capturing in that familial risk is both environmental exposures as well as a genetic exposure. And so the million-dollar question is, what aspect of either the shared environment or the genetics is contributing to that risk pathway?
So when you say someone who grew up in a lower socioeconomic background is more vulnerable, what do you mean? What are the characteristics of that type of life that of the people that you're studying?
Well, you hit the nail on the head when you introduced it. Not only does the stress of economics affect things like our bank account, but it can be affecting our children who grow up in those environments where mom and dad are struggling to make ends meet, pay the bills, working more than one job, working long hours. And so when we're looking at lower socioeconomic status, which is what we've focused on in this study, this is where folks might have $20,000, $30,000 a year that they're living on and having to support two or three children and maintain a household. It's not extreme poverty that we've observed in our study, which is a population-based study of adolescents growing up in San Antonio, Texas, but more of not having as much in order to make ends meet and live.
So are we looking more at what might be referred to as, say, the working poor, people who are not completely destitute but are really, really under-resourced?
Yes, that would be a very fair statement.
So how were you able to tell that these young people were at a greater risk for depression?
Well, what we did is we designed a study to identify 12 to 15-year-old adolescents, and then we randomly selected them from a 30-mile radius around San Antonio proper, and then brought them in and assessed them and their parents and identified lifetime psychiatric disorders in first and second degree relatives. And if they had high loading in both first and second degree with lifetime depression, they were brought in as high risk, or they had no depression in first degree relatives and little to none in second degree relatives. They comprised a low risk group.
We're talking with Douglas Williamson right now. He's professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University. He's a co-author of a study that looks at poverty and the effect that it can have on people's DNA and their risk of depression. So what are the biological workings at play here? Is there something particularly fluid about the development of an adolescent brain that makes them that much more susceptible?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the key brain regions, the amygdala, is sensitive to environmental stimuli that arouse anger and fear. And so the first biological response that you've got is mediated through the amygdala. The prefrontal cortex, which regulates, has inputs back to the amygdala, is developing during that period of time. So kids are much more, adolescents are much more excitable and much less able to inhibit that excitability during that period of development.
And a study from earlier this year from Washington University in St. Louis found that adverse circumstances early in life impacted the development and function of young brains. That seems like this might be connected to what you're looking at as well.
Yeah, it's very similar in that way. And by looking at the brain twice during development, once between 12 and 15, and a second time between 14 and 17, we're actually able to map developmental changes during that key period of adolescent development that changes, identify what's unique among kids at risk for depression compared to kids not at risk for depression, and really start to identify what the brain-based and genetic-based mechanisms that contribute to that risk pathway are.
This might be getting ahead of where your research is now, but do you have a sense of whether these changes can be reversed, or are these permanent changes that, these young people who will be full adults soon will be carrying for the rest of their lives?
So one of the things that we haven't talked about so far is that the old school thinking in genetics is that you have a genetic structure that you inherit. It predicts things like eye color, height, hair color. It also has been previously identified that aspects of our genome predict increased risk for different types of behaviors and types of symptoms, sometimes by themselves, sometimes with symptoms. What we've been discovering through this process, what's called epigenetics, is that with DNA methylation, where on one aspect of our genome, we have these little methyl tags that occur, it can actually increase or decrease the expression of that gene, which contributes to different amounts of proteins and downstream biological functions that are happening. And so environment, sleep, diet, temperature, all of these things can change the epigenetic state of our genome and is reversible. And importantly, folks have begun to identify is transmittable to the next generation, making them more or less susceptible.
So I just want to make sure I'm understanding this. So it sounds like there are certain factors, genetic factors that are there, but it's almost like different circumstances either turn the volume up or down on them.
That's correct. Okay. That's absolutely correct.
So this sounds like it's really pretty groundbreaking research and opening up whole different ways of understanding what goes on in the brain. It also seems like it's opening up a lot of opportunities for different ways to approach these problems and these issues that people are living with.
Absolutely. And we're still at the very early stages in this work, but you could fast forward 20 years from now and see how aspects of these early epigenetic changes could be used to screen people who are vulnerable for developing a first episode of depression that has lifelong implications and intervene earlier.
And so looking at it on a very concrete level, what might healthcare providers, say in a clinical setting, or say a school nurse, or even people who are not medically trained but are interacting with young people, what are some of the applications that you could see this having?
At this point, stress affects all of our lives. It affects our children as they're growing, and particularly vulnerable kids. And so I think the first line at this point in time is helping kids learn to manage and deal healthily with stress that they're exposed to. Sometimes it's things that they've got themselves involved in or familial environments that they're coming from. Again, down the road, 20 years from now, I think we will begin to have blood-based tests that may index things like DNA methylation of particular genes that can be used to help identify kids who could benefit more from intervention.
You're looking specifically at depression, but are there indications that other psychological issues and conditions might also be the result of some of these genetic mutations that happen?
Absolutely. In fact, I am part of the Consortium to Alleviate PTSD, which is a national research action plan that has identified a consortium to ameliorate the war scars of post-traumatic stress disorder. And there, what we're doing is we're looking at human postmortem tissue, we're looking at pre-post deployment samples, pre-post treatment to identify what these genetic biomarkers are that identify the presence of PTSD, the risk to develop PTSD, and indicators of treatment response. And so there's one where we actually have a very large consortium effort to identify the molecular, i.e. genetic signatures of that disorder.
And as we wrap up, Doug, is this something that might also have influence on public policy? Because there's certainly medical applications and psychological applications, but a lot of those are driven by public policy as well.
Absolutely. And I think the move in our nation towards precision medicine and beginning to integrate biology into understanding our health trajectories is exactly headed in that direction.
Well, Doug, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Doug Williamson, professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Duke University. He co-authored a study finding that growing up in poverty can affect people's DNA and put them at higher risk for depression. Coming up after the news, women could soon be required to register for the Selective Service under a plan approved by the U.S. Senate. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Listening to Central Time, I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, a reporter explains why Brown County is the state's biggest political battleground in the coming November elections. First, last week, the U.S. Senate approved a measure that would require women to register for selective service, better known as the draft. While the draft hasn't been used since the Vietnam War, men are still required to register for the selective service once they turn 18. If they don't, young men can't qualify for financial aid for higher education, and there can be other penalties down the line as well. However, up to this point, women have been exempt from this requirement since they were not able to have combat roles in any of the armed services until recently. And we want to hear from you. Should women be required to register for the draft? Why or why not? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page. You can also send us an email at talk@wpr.org. Joining us now to talk about this is Nora Bensahel. She's a distinguished scholar in residence at the School of International Service at American University and has researched the role of the armed services and the draft extensively. Nora, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much for having me.
So how long has the discussion about whether to have women sign up for the Selective Service been going on?
Well, really, it started when the Selective Service system was established in 1973, when the United States moved from having a conscript military to the all-volunteer force. But it's really come back in the debate since December of last year, when Secretary of Defense Ash Carter announced that all positions in the U.S. military, including combat positions, would be open to women for the first time, that women could serve equally in all units. That raised the question that if women can serve in every position, in the Army now, which they couldn't before, should they also be required to register for the draft to serve their nation in time of need?
So basically, because women were not eligible to serve in many of the positions that in a more traditional form of war were really kind of the key of key places where drafted soldiers would serve, it didn't seem to make sense.
Well, they were prevented from serving by the law, and that law had been challenged in the courts on two different occasions, and the Supreme Court ruled that women could be, but they were sued by women who wanted to be able to register for selective service, believing it was an equal, that equal opportunity in society equals equal responsibility. And what the Supreme Court ruled was that women could be excluded from the draft, segregated out because of their sex, because women were not allowed to serve in every combat position in the Army, and therefore there was a compelling reason to exclude women from the draft. That's why this debate has come back, because that was the reasoning that the Supreme Court used. That reason has now gone away, and that's why there's been more interest in discussing this and people pressing this issue.
So how did the bill make it to the Senate floor this time?
Well, it came up through a very convoluted way. It came up in the House originally by a representative named Duncan Hunter from California, who did something very unusual. He introduced the bill requiring women to register for the draft, saying that he was going to vote against it. Usually members of Congress don't introduce bills that they explicitly announce they are opposed to, but he wanted to force a debate on this issue and thought that introducing that amendment would do so. He brought it up in the House Armed Services Committee, despite the fact that he did, in fact, vote against it. It actually passed from the committee. Several Republicans broke rank with what Duncan Hunter apparently assumed they would do and voted with Democrats to pass the amendment, and it ended up being passed as part of the House Defense Authorization Bill. The Senate brought it up as well. It's passed in the Senate version. That doesn't mean it's law yet. The two houses still need to work out the differences between their bills in a conference committee, and it's possible it could change, but it seems unlikely now given that both houses of Congress have passed legislation that will require women to register for the draft.
So who was coming out strongly opposing having women register with Selective Service?
A number of conservative Republicans have come out against it. Duncan Hunter has been one of the most explicit, but there have, were others that joined him as well. The issue came up, as I said, as soon as Secretary Carter made the announcement about women in combat positions in December. It's really important to note, though, that the military supports this. Both the chiefs of staff of both the Army and the Commandant of the Marine Corps, the leaders of the two land forces of the United States, both testified in front of Congress in February that they supported having women register for the draft now that that policy has been changed.
And why do you think that the armed services seem to be so overwhelmingly in favor of this measure?
The truth is the all-volunteer force today couldn't exist without women, even given the exclusions that they've had. Women serve in about 15% of military positions, and they're really a vital part of how the military operates today. I think that, again, given that now there are no restrictions on where they can serve, you know, by policy, it's very important to mention that doesn't mean that all women will necessarily serve in combat positions, mm-hmm. just the same way that men who would be drafted would not necessarily serve in combat positions. Anybody who's going to be in an infantry unit, in an armor unit, or something like that has to pass the physical requirements in order to serve in those positions. That would be true for women as well. But now that there's no policy reason to exclude them, I think that it just makes logical sense that if the purpose of the draft is to mobilize a population to support the military in case of national emergency, we're not talking about day-to-day volunteering to serve in the military, that the equal responsibility of citizenship requires women to have that opportunity as well.
You said that many of the opponents of adding women to the selective service requirement are from conservative Republicans, and yet they seem to more often be very much in step with the opinions of the armed services and military commanders. But on this, it sounds like they're on very different sides of the issue.
Yes, they are. And the most common element of the opposition to this is, you know, some variant of the argument, I just can't imagine my daughter serving in war, or our nation's daughter shouldn't be required to be killed on behalf of the nation. In that sense, this, you know, I think that what it's playing on is a cultural element of society. There's still part of society that very much resists that, and that's where the opposition is coming from. Whereas the military leaders are looking at this as a pure military manpower issue, as they should.
And you mentioned that the two parts of Congress, the House and the Senate, each pass their own bills. They'll need to find the common ground on that. It would then go to President Obama for signature. Where do we know, what do we know about where he stands on this?
I don't think he's come out and entered this debate explicitly, but I would, if it passes both houses of Congress and military leaders explicitly support it, I would be shocked if he, you know, decided to veto it. It's almost inconceivable.
We're talking with Nora Bensahal, distinguished scholar in residence at the School of International Service at American University. And we want to hear from you. Are you reconsidering the idea of selective service? Should we ever consider drafting young Americans to fight in a war, or should we rely on the all-volunteer army? Does adding women to selective service make it more fair? Why or why not? You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Now, Nora, the armed services in the United States are some of the most advanced in the world, and many people do enlist voluntarily. So there is an argument that some make that the selective service is not necessary at this point in our nation's history, and with how different war is now than the traditional warfare that past generations faced. What do you say to those who would argue maybe we don't need selective service at all?
I think we absolutely do need to keep the selective service because it is the only way to mobilize the population in the unlikely event of a large-scale war. That kind of war that would require more than the military could generate through volunteers is very difficult to conceive of today, but it would be of profound importance for the nation, even in the very unlikely event that it were to happen, that we need to maintain some mechanism to have the population enter the military in case we are in a bigger war in the future. So the question of whether we should continue to have a draft or not, I think, is at its very fundamental core about preparation for even some wildly unimaginable scenarios, but that would be potentially devastating if they happened. That's a separate question, though, from whether the selective service system should be maintained in its current format, mm-hmm. whether we have the right mechanisms for utilizing it, for calling people up, whether we would assign people to different positions in ways that are different from today. Those are all very important questions, but those are separate from, you know, the core question of whether the United States needs to maintain a draft in case of national emergency.
In a recent piece, you made a very interesting analysis of the situation of who might need to be drafted and need to be called up quickly in a conflict that the U.S. needed to respond to rapidly. And you talked about the fact that we may need to suddenly call up people who have computer coding skills or financial skills in case of an attack on the financial sector, or even social media skills. How would we be able to find those people, even if everyone was of a certain age registered for selective service?
Well, that does get to how the mechanisms of a draft would be implemented. But you know, in the event that we needed to go to a draft, or that we needed to draft in certain select capabilities, we'd be, you know, screening people and bringing them in. It might be, for example, when you register with the Selective Service, you have to indicate expertise in some areas, even at the age of 18. You know, if you're leaning towards being a techie rather than a liberal arts major, something along those lines. The details would certainly have to be considered as to exactly the mechanisms for doing that. But I think that thinking about, you know, needing to draft people into positions that are not just, you know, close combat in the infantry or shooting large cannons and artillery or the armor, you know, this does acknowledge that the nature of war has changed. If we do have a large-scale draft, we would be bringing in people And assigning them, as the draft has always done, to where they are of the most military need. If we needed people with cyber experience, for example, when they came through the door of the drafting office, if they were called up in whatever mechanism we create to have that, you know, someone like that might be assigned to a cyber unit rather than an infantry unit, for example.
So let's go back to the mechanics of the measure that would have young women registering for the Selective Service along with their male counterparts. What actually do they need to do, and who would be affected? Say this goes into place, let's just say September 1st of this year. Who would need to start registering?
Well, young women would need to do exactly the same thing that their male counterparts do today, which is that every male, and in, you know, this world, female, who turns age 18 is required to register with the Selective Service. If they do not do so, they are not eligible for certain forms of federal financial aid. That's usually the biggest incentive for people who, you know, who might think about not registering. You must certify that you have registered, and that is double checked in order to receive federal financial aid for school. But you can be fined and penalized if you have not registered for it in other ways as well. And so, what women would have to do is the same as what men do: is to simply provide their contact information and register with the Selective Service organization, which is a very, very short process and not very difficult to do. You're also required, if your address changes, I think if you're between the ages of 18 and 25, but I might have that cut off, not quite right, to notify the Selective Service if your address changes.
And if there's a young woman who, when this goes into effect, is, say, 21, would she need to go back and register, or is this just moving forward with women 18 as they turn 18?
So that would depend on the exact language that comes out of, you know, what Congress agrees on. And since there's still room for compromise on that between the two houses, we don't know the exact answer to that question yet.
And just as we wrap up, Nora, you've been following this issue for a very long time. How would you gauge public opinion right now about service in the military in general and adding women to the Selective Service?
Well, I think the broad spectrum of public opinion is very supportive of requiring women to register for the draft. Again, the context of women being allowed to serve in any position in the military now, I think for most people it just makes sense. That if women can serve in any position, there's no reason they should be treated any differently than their male counterparts. What this has done, though, is it has sparked a larger debate on whether we need a draft in the first place, which we were talking about earlier. And as I said, I think that's a separate question, a really important one, but you do see a lot more different public opinion on that. But I think if you ask people, you know, if you take out the question of whether the draft should exist at all, if, you know, you believe it's going to continue to exist, then there's a tremendous amount of public support for having women register. And you're seeing that reflected in the fact that it passed in both houses of Congress.
Well, Nora, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Nora Bensahel is a distinguished scholar in residence at the School of International Service at American University. She joined us to talk about a recent proposal approved by the U.S. Senate to require women to register for the draft. And we'll get to your calls in a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Before the break, we learned about the proposal in the U.S. Senate that would require women to register for the draft, and we asked for your calls. And first up is Katie in Two Rivers. Hi, Katie.
Hi there.
What do you have to say?
Well, I recently, just in May, I commissioned as an officer in the military, but for a long time, I've always questioned why women were not required to register for Selective Service, especially considering the big push and fight for equal pay, and especially since women are now allowed to be in combat. I kind of saw this coming, but at the same time, I'm also fairly conservative and religious, and I have an understanding and a respect for the traditional roles of women and men, and I can see why it's a hot subject, but especially, I think of other examples of other countries like Israel and how women are, as far as I understand, equally responsible for protecting their country. And yeah.
Right. And there are countries like Israel where it's mandatory service for both genders. Thank you so much for that call, Katie. Let's go now to Dorothy in Greendale. Hi, Dorothy.
Yes, hi. I'm a progressive, and I'm in my 70s, and I am for equal rights for men and women. However, one thing I want to bring up is that I was a leader in the Equal Rights Amendment movement in the 70s. I was a member of the National Organization for Women, and we brought thousands of people to Springfield, Illinois, to try and pass that amendment. And the United States failed by just a couple states, Illinois being one of them. The main opponent of it in Illinois was Phyllis Schlafly, an attorney, and her main argument was if that Equal Rights Amendment gets passed for men and women to be equal, becomes part of the U.S. Constitution, women will be drafted into combat.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why it got defeated in a progressive state like Illinois, which was mainly Democratic in those days. And now I am just kind of upset that we still don't have equal pay. We don't have equal rights guaranteed to us. Alice Paul recommended that way back, that we have that put into the U.S. Constitution.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to get the draft.
So Dorothy, you're saying that we didn't get the Equal Rights Amendment because of the draft, and now we have the draft without the Equal Rights Amendment.
Right, and we don't have equal pay for equal work either. Since I worked on that issue in the 70s, it's hardly changed.
All right, well, thank you so much for that call, Dorothy. And now let's move to Tim in Eau Claire. Hi, Tim.
A couple quick points. One, I feel like the draft argument is kind of a moot point. As long as there are still people around who remember Vietnam, because I feel like unless we were actually attacked in the U.S., that you would be really hard-pressed to find any support for an actual draft that wouldn't end in horrible protests and things of that nature. And secondly, in terms of equality, if you are going to have a draft in place, you can't pick and choose equality.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Tim. And on Facebook, Lucia says, women should be able to sign up for the draft. There are arguments against this, but they are unfounded. Women's reflexes are better than men's, and the world's population is enough that we don't need to worry about going extinct. Thanks for that post, Lucia. And John in Beloit is next. Let's go there. Hi, John.
Hello. I think this is a great idea. I think it's completely fair and across the board. I think the greatest thing they're going to have to overcome is they're going to need to establish baseline standards for the positions. Infantry people need to be able to do certain things and things like that. Firefighters need to be able to do certain things. All the positions in the military are not equal, carrying certain weight loads and things like that. And those things will need to be established. I mean, they're going to have to be. The PFTs will also have to be established in baseline. And just not just so people can pass, but so that they fit the criteria of the job. Now, the PFT should be standard, but the job requirement may be different. So that's my opinion on it. And I think that's one of the greatest obstacles there's going to be, because there'll be a lot of pushback, because people are going to say, well, I can't do that PFT. And the other people are going to be, well, I want to be able to do this job. But
okay,
not.
John, let me ask you for a second, for those of us without a military background, what does PFT mean?
Physical fitness testing.
Physical fitness.
Like running 3 miles in, 18 minutes, 20 pull-ups minimum, 88 sit-ups in 2 minutes, and things like that.
All right. Well, John, have you served with women in the military before?
Yes. My wife is a Marine, and I'm a Marine.
And so as far as women being added to the Selective Service, do you and your wife think that's a good idea?
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that call, John. And then we had Michelle in Madison, who said that she thinks that if women are going to get equal rights in our society, they should be registering right along with men. And that's just the way the direction is going, and it should be right now. Thank you for that comment, Michelle. And we want to hear from you on the Central Time Facebook page. We can continue this conversation. Does it still serve an important purpose to have the Selective Service? As our guest mentioned, the draft might look very different for a new generation. There might be a draft that would target specifically people with computer skills or social media skills or financial skills. Is it important that we be able to pull from a pool of people who are already registered to be able to fill those needs? And if you don't think that women should be registered for the Selective Service, do you think men still should be? Or is that an idea that the all-volunteer volunteer military force has really made obsolete. We'd like to hear what you think on this and other topics at the Central Time Facebook page. You can also email your thoughts to talk@WPR.org, and we'll be happy to put that information up on the Facebook page. You can also read a recent article by Nora Ben-Sahel on this topic at the Central Time Facebook page. Well, there are always new restaurants opening up, but one that's getting a lot of attention, at least in some circles, is a Golden Girls-themed cafe that is set to open in New York City in September. The person behind it was the best friend of the late Rue McClanahan, who played Blanche on the show. He inherited a lot of memorabilia from her, and that will add to the decor of the eatery. And joining me now in the studio is Central Time producer Halima Shah, who, like me, is a big fan of the show. So, Halima, what do you think they'll be serving in the Golden Girls Cafe? It's called Rue La Rue, by the way.
Ooh, that's a good name. For one thing, definitely cheesecake.
Right. There was always cheesecake in the kitchen, in the refrigerator for any crisis, even big or small.
For any crisis. And I think that this new establishment might end up being the ultimate stress eater's paradise.
It's true.
Yeah. And I think maybe some Norwegian food to represent Rosen Island's heritage.
So. And some Italian dishes for Sofia Petrillo. She was always cooking something up. And Betty White, actually, who played Rosen Island on the show and at 94 years old is the oldest last cast member still alive, is planning to attend the opening. One thing I was surprised, Halima, it's not going to be in Brooklyn, where the Petrillos and the Zborniaks were from.
It's disappointing, but I'm going to try to make my way there.
I think we should.
And maybe get some carry out in a box that looks like Sophia Petrillo's purse.